Mr. Trofimov, 3-1.
By the sound of your name, it sounds like a Russian name to me.
It is.
Can you tell me the background to it, please?
Well, my father was Russian, but I was born in England, and I'm a British subject.
How did your father come to be in the country?
He left Russia in the first revolution, and came over here and became a lecturer at Cambridge in the Russian language, and eventually he held the chair at Manchester University.
Whereabouts in Britain were you born?
I was born in Manchester, Victoria Park.
Were you educated in Manchester?
Only as a very young child, I went to a prep school. And then, for reasons of health, I was sent to the south of France, where my parents had a property. And I continued with my schooling at Menton, which is on the Italian frontier, from the age of 7 to 13. I then came back to England and continued my education in England at Queen Elizabeth's Grammar School, Ashbourne, Derbyshire, until I'd taken my school certificate and subsequent qualifications.
So were you fluent in French?
Yes. I'm supposed to be totally fluent. I obviously had a great advantage in spending all those younger years in France. And throughout my life, French has played a very important part in my life. I don't know how far you want to go into it, but it clearly had an influence on my getting into SOE and becoming a gen, because it was important to be able to speak French. And this, together with the fact that I, in the earlier days of the war, I managed to get a distinction in the signals school at Catterick. Both of these helped enormously, because if you could manage French and you had signals, you had a head start.
Would you in those early days pass as a Frenchman in your speech?
Yes, in fact, when I first came over to England, when I came back to England at 13, I'm told I had a slight accent, which I subsequently obviously ironed out. But now,
when war was declared in September 1939, what were you doing and what was your reaction?
My first reaction was utter dismay, because I was enormously happy as a young man. At the time, I was in France at the time, in our property with my mother. And I was looking forward to going to university. My father had secured me a place in the School of Architecture, because I'd always had a slightly artistic bent, and it seemed a practical way of using that, rather than to just become a painter or something, which I wouldn't have been all that good at. And at the start of war, I went to Manchester University, and because of my age, I wasn't called up, and I completed 2 years before I had to go into the war. I think it was the October 41. When I finally joined up.
What happened to you on joining up?
Oh, I was sent to a barracks in Preston, absolutely ghastly place, and I was an ordinary soldier, and it was, but it was an RA, Royal Artillery Barracks training, and I went through, you know, the basic training of, you know, rifle drill and gymnastics and all sorts of things. And I disliked the place so much that whenever there was a chance to go on a course, I grabbed at it and I went on all sorts of courses, even to Bren carriers and stuff like that. But I think the one I enjoyed most was in 42, I think it was July, I was sent to the Royal School of Signals at Catterick. And that was, I think, about a, as I remember, it was about 9 weeks or so, 3 months, wait a minute, 7, 4, 2, 3, 9, it was 2 months course, yes. And I don't know whether it's because of languages, my ability to speak languages, and which is, has a kind of music, signals with Morse, etc., came to me quite easily, and also there was the visual signals. And when I got back to the barracks at Preston, there was a certain amount of excitement because I'd passed with a distinction, and I was immediately made into a bombardier.
What was there about barracks life that you particularly disliked?
I'm a loner. I think the immediate answer to that is I've always been a loner, and I didn't particularly like sleeping in a huge warehouse with hundreds of other people, some of whom were extremely crude, very crude. But I got on with it and made my own niche. I soon found an answer to that. And I volunteered to be the local, the barracks librarian, which involved having your own little bed. So I did that, and I always found some way of easing the situation or making life a little more pleasant. But I made some very good friends amongst the you know, fellow troopers. No great objection to that. It was just the general conditions were pretty awful.
How did you react to regimentation?
I got on with it. I realised that one had to do it, but I've already said to you, I'm a loner. And I think some people are company men, regimental men. Others are not, and I'm not in that bracket. And clearly, if you have probably spoken to a few other Jeds, you'll find that they were the same types. They were loners, and it was one of the reasons why we volunteered, amongst others. In my case, I wanted to get back to France and help the French as much as I could.
Could we go on now to 1943, when I think that you volunteered for Special Forces, and can you tell me precisely how it came about?
Yes, I can. I was, at the time, I was with a field regiment in Sussex, and I was literally bored to tears. I think I've already said I found regimental life rather tedious. You were merely repeating what everybody else had been doing for years, kowtowing to the colonel, and who, you know, lorded it over everybody. And I was getting really fed up with the whole setup, and I couldn't see very much future for me in the regiment. And one day, a sign came up on the notice board asking for volunteers for special duties. knowledge of French required. And I think it mentioned signals as well. And this seemed to be the very thing I needed or wanted. And I approached the colonel, made an appointment to see him, and he tried to poo-poo the whole thing. He said, you don't want to go into this cloak and dagger stuff, and you're an RA officer and part of a regiment and this, that and the other. And he tried to dissuade me, actually, which only made me more adamant than ever. And so I volunteered, and after that started a rather unusual period of where I had to go to London and go through a series of tests, and some of them were quite the tests of your character, of your patience, and just about every aspect of your character. I passed, evidently, the initial general tests and had to go back to my regiment, which had then moved to Ireland as an advance party. And we were doing training exercises when I got the signal to go back to London area, where I attended a series of interviews, which lasted 3 days. So 6 days, I think, in all. It was from the 13th to the 19th of January 44. And that was quite fascinating, because they did all sorts of things to you and put you through all sorts of tests, physical, mental, and what have you.
Can you give some examples?
Yes, one example that sticks out very much in my mind was that I was locked up in a cellar and told to try and get out. Well, in my case, my architectural beginnings helped me again, my architectural studies. I looked at the walls and I couldn't see any real evidence. Then I noticed some loose bricks at ceiling height, and I scraped away, and there was a convenient duct. So I went, I crawled along this duct, and it led to a grate where I was able to get out. So I thought I'd have some fun. I proceeded very quietly along the side of the building to where a guard was, and got behind him and took him in a grip and held my two fingers and said, "You're dead." And he played ball. And I went into the main building, presented myself at one of the officers' door, I can't remember which one, and said, "I'm here. I could technically shoot you." There was a certain amount of laughter in it, but that was one of the tests, and there were a lot of written tests as well.
Of what kind?
Asking you about all sorts of questions, your reactions to this and that, and there was one incident I remember. We were dining, and suddenly somebody let off a pistol immediately behind one. And I think that was to see what your reaction was in sort of emergencies and things like that. But I can't remember an awful lot now of the actual it's a long time ago.
Where did this take place?
At a private house somewhere outside London. I remember going to a station, being told to wait there, and a car came up and collected me. Some people may have found out where it is. I've never bothered to find out, but it was some distance out of London in one of the military establishments. There are a number, as you know.
What type of people were around in this place?
Oh, a number of officers, all from different regiments. I don't remember any at that time very distinctly. I think there was one I remembered. But there were young lieutenants, captains, majors, all walks of life, who'd obviously volunteered like myself. And this was a process of thinning out. I gather that from something like 100 original volunteers, we were whittled down to about 50. And even then, after that, once we got to Milton Hall, ME65, the process carried on, and every now and again a face would disappear. Obviously, certain characteristics were thought not to be suitable for somebody who was going to be dropped behind lines and, you know, have to live rough.
Did you gather what kind of personal characteristics would have been unsuitable?
No, I don't think so. I think they were looking possibly for a certain amount of stability in people, and people that didn't panic, I would think. People that didn't get flustered in an emergency. If you're behind the lines, and it's one long emergency in a sense, I think they would also be looking for somebody with a certain amount of stamina to be able to put up with living in very rough conditions and able to cope with fear. Because I don't give a damn what anybody says when you're behind the lines. There is always the fear that you're going to be caught. You know that you're surrounded by people who, some even French, who can betray you. But the enemy's forever looking for you. So I think stamina and being able to cope with adverse conditions and the element of fear, I should think. I mean, I may be wrong, but that's my assessment, purely my assessment.
During this process of training, did you have at all any doubts about what you had let yourself in for?
Never. Not at one stage. I loved every minute of becoming a Jedba. To this day, I still am very proud of the fact that I was a Jed. I think you've spoken to Ruby Rubenstein, and he and I are great friends. We've kept very close together. We have reunions every 3 or 4 years, latterly, starting in 84. Before that, we had reunions in England and France. I've kept in touch with many of them, and I feel that they are... It's like being part of a big family. And the excitement, I don't know how anybody could feel that they were in the wrong thing, because it was so exciting. The training was so varied. So to the person who volunteered at that time, like myself, mostly individuals, call them loners if you like, the course was a tremendous challenge. You had to learn all sorts of things which were not being taught in the regular or in the army, i.e. guerrilla warfare. The army rather looked down at the time on these tactics. Now perhaps they have a different view. But sabotage was a very interesting subject, with all we had to learn with explosives and the use of explosives and mines and certain other weaponry. Not only our own, but German weaponry. The physical side I liked, because I, as a young boy, I'd always been very keen on gymnastics and athletics. And, of course, there's unarmed combat. And I was one of the few that really liked the combat course. What is it called? I've forgotten the name of it now. Where you had to climb walls and sling yourself down ropes across rivers and all that. I really enjoyed that sort of thing.
Just going back to when you were recruited to SOE, did you know the names of any of the people who interviewed you?
No. And I think that is important. In fact, it was only after the war that one began to. Clearly, if you're going to go behind lines, the least you know about anybody, the better. This end. So, for instance, the French that joined us all had nom de guerre, and one didn't really form other than one's own team. You didn't have time for it, and the less you knew about the various other elements, the better. And certainly the people that interviewed us, they were just faces. I don't think many of us ever bothered with their names. One was too concerned with getting on with the tests and the conditions that we were being subjected to.
So if we can rejoin the narrative now, you said that you went from this country hall sort of place to Milton Hall.
Yes, I presume, I think looking at the dates, I must have had a holiday. It was around, you know, January, early January. And then I think it was towards the end of, I think it must have been towards the end of January, I turned up at Milton Hall. They weren't really ready until, looking at the history that has been written by another Jed, they weren't really ready till about the 1st of February 1944 to really start the course, and it was a two months intensive course. We were supposed to be ready by April, so it was February, March, and into April. But obviously some of us, I didn't go in until July, so we carried on training right up to, you know, a week or two before going in.
Can you tell me what the course was like at Milton Hall?
What the course?
The course was like?
Yes, very, very well thought out. Very, very interesting. It covered a whole series of subjects. Obviously, it was completely new to us in that you had to learn the tactics of guerrilla warfare, which are totally different to that of an army. For instance, in guerrilla warfare, you don't have the benefits of medics and hospitals behind you, so you go in and attack. And usually, when conditions are as favorable as possible to your side, and then get out quickly. So we had to do to learn all about guerrilla warfare tactics. We had to learn sabotage. This involved getting to coming to being able to handle explosives in various forms, such as to blow up bridges. Mine roads, booby traps, and all this sort of thing. We had to be quite adept at close range use of pistols and the carbine, the American carbine, which we were all equipped with. The other thing that we did, the officers had to learn the basics of signal communications, because in the event of the radio operator being caught or killed or something, one still had to be able to communicate with London, with base, with HQ. And I was lucky in this that because of my earlier experiences in Catterick, and the course I'd done there, I found this part of it very easy, and actually occasionally they used me as an instructor on that, for the Morse particularly. Then there was the physical side. We had to do these combat courses. We had to do the long marches. We did very interesting exercises where we were dropped off the back of a lorry, which was supposed to be parachuting, and had to live off the land. And virtually live as if one was in France or behind the lines. The people you were with were interesting, because at Milton, I don't know how much you know about it, but the idea was for a team of three to go in: an Englishman, a French officer, if it was the case of France, and a radio operator who could be either American, French, or British. Or it would be an American officer with a French officer and a radio operator. Didn't always work like that, because for a number of reasons, in some cases, I gathered two British officers went in, or two, depended on the circumstances in the area that you went into. I'm trying to think of anything else that I might have missed out. A lot, of course, we did an awful lot of gymnastics, you know, gym classes to keep us as fit as possible and to ensure that our reflexes were good. The other aspect, of course, was quite interesting, that the Americans, who are part of OSS, Office of Strategic Services, wanted to remain as such. They always they were cooperating. They were not coming under SOE, and this had a rather amusing side effect in that we had wonderful breakfasts with all these American sort of bits and pieces, and because the French came into it, of course, we managed to get Algerian wine with dinner occasionally. But this, I think, made it all the more fascinating. And one thing in particular I thought was very good: no matter what rank you were, you within the course itself, rank did not count at all. If you had a major standing next to you, didn't matter, you know, in the course, he was the same as you. You know, it was a complete leveled out process. So that we were all just basically volunteers to be dreads, and it didn't matter. You didn't have to sort of, because there was a major next to you, you didn't have to step aside to let him do things or whatever. We were all treated as equals.
How did your team of three come to be formed?
I think we it was possibly in the mess that you know, during the when you were on the course, you didn't have time to really get to know people very much, other than to observe the way they operated on the various training courses. I think in my case, looking back, I met André Durand in the mess. There was something about him that I liked. He was an experienced officer. He'd come from North Africa.